Well, we are continuing on with our study of the book of Ruth, and today we've come to the final chapter of Ruth. We're going to look at that last chapter in two parts, so this week we'll look at verses 1 through 12, and next week, Lord willing, we will conclude the series by looking at the final section. My plan after Ruth is to begin a study of 1 Corinthians, so that'll take us a while. That's a longer epistle. But Ruth chapter 4, verse 1, is on page 224 in the Pew Bible, by the way, if you're using that, 224. We'll look at verses 1 through 12 this morning. Hear the word of the Lord. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer, of whom Boaz had spoken, came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend. Sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me, that I may know. For there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." Thus far, the reading of God's holy and inspired word, and all God's people said, Amen. Well, chapter 3 of Ruth, which we studied last week, ended with Boaz expressing his willingness to marry Ruth and thus fulfill the role of the kinsman redeemer, perpetuating the name of Elimelech in his inheritance. But Boaz's willingness did not make it a done deal. There was a potential complication, and Boaz mentioned it at the end of chapter 3. There was another guy. There was another man in Bethlehem who was a closer blood relation to Naomi's family than Boaz was. And so because they're applying the kinsman redeemer custom to this situation, the law didn't exactly require that they do so, but they're doing so. And because they're doing that, this means that this other man needs to be given first right of refusal regarding the redemption of Ruth and the property that was entitled to her deceased husband. Now, we noted in last week's sermon that Boaz was taking a considerable risk in bringing this matter to the other kinsman's attention. It might mean that Boaz would have to step aside and let the other kinsman marry Ruth. He's letting go of her for just a second at least to see what the Lord has for him. And this passage shows us, interestingly, that there's another risk here. There's a risk involved in filling the role of kinsman redeemer under these circumstances. And at the end, we see that Boaz is willing to take on those risks too. He took on the risk of doing the right thing and letting go of Ruth and giving this other man the opportunity. And now he's taking on the risk of being the kinsman redeemer. And that shows something, once again, about his character. It shows him to be a man who prioritizes doing what is right and doing what is good above seeking his own interests. We know what he wants. He wants to marry Ruth. He's delighted with this possibility. And yet, he's willing to take this risk, and then also he's willing to take on the risks involved in marrying Ruth. And really, that makes him a perfect match for Ruth when you think about it. Ruth is a woman who forsook her people, her country, her gods, in order to care for her grief-stricken mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law who is basically paralyzed with grief, as we've seen earlier in the book. So we begin by looking at the beginning of chapter 4, looking in verse 1. And this chapter begins by telling us that Boaz went to the city gates to wait for this other potential redeemer. And in those days, city gates were complex structures. They had towers, they had rooms, they were meeting places, gathering places. Now, certainly their chief purpose was for the defense of the city, but they were also used as this public square for the town. It was the place where the administrative and judicial business of the community was conducted. And so you could say that the gates of Bethlehem would be somewhat like a modern-day city hall. So as Boaz sits down at the gate, who should arrive but the other guy, the other potential redeemer? And notice how the author describes this. There's a couple of things about the way this is described that's very significant. First of all, the writer says, "And behold, the redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by." You see, here we have another apparent coincidence, similar to the one that was described back in chapter 2, where Ruth just happened to go gleaning in the field that belonged to Boaz. Now, that wasn't a coincidence, and this isn't a coincidence either. Instead, this is the narrator's way of calling our attention to the Lord's control over these events. We're meant to look at the things that are taking place in these characters' lives through the lenses of divine providence. And there's a lesson in that for our own lives. This is something that we should strive to do in all of the events and all of the circumstances of our lives. The things that take place in your life do not happen due to chance. They don't happen due to coincidence. They're not merely the result of your own choices and actions, nor are they merely the result of the choices and actions of the people around you. Now, it's certainly true that human beings are always responsible for their actions. It's also true, though, that the Lord is always in control, and he is mysteriously working out his purpose. Now, there's another small but important detail in verse 1, and that detail is the name by which the other potential redeemer is identified as Boaz addresses him. Now, in the ESV and in many other English translations, it has Boaz addressing the man as friend. That's not what the original Hebrew says. It's actually, the King James is the closest to the original here. I think it says certain one. So the Hebrew is, it's an unusual construction a little bit, and there's kind of a rhyme actually in it. But a more literal translation would be like something like a certain someone or certain one, something like that. It's a strange way of addressing somebody. If you wanted to use a more contemporary idiom, you know, what it would sound like in our day, it's like Boaz is addressing this man by a designation like, hey, so-and-so, or hey, what's your name, or hey, you. Now, that kind of stands out, because we know that Boaz knows the man's name. He knows who he is. Why does the author leave his name out? And on top of that, the author of Ruth has been very particular about giving us names, the names of the principal characters in this story, even the ones who die just a few verses into the book. And certainly this other potential redeemer, he plays an important role in what's transpiring here, and yet he's not named. He's left unnamed in order to express a sense of poetic justice. I think that's what's going on here, and other commentators would agree with that. As we're about to see, the reason why this man refused to serve as Ruth's redeemer was because of his desire to preserve his own lineage, which is another way of saying to preserve his own name, to perpetuate his name. And so there's an irony here. There's an ironic twist. His name is not even recounted in the telling of the story. He's a forgotten man. In trying to save his name, he lost it. I'm not saying that that has something to do with his salvation or anything like that, but I think there's a point being made here. Now, once Boaz has gotten the other man's attention and called him to himself, he begins to gather witnesses for what's about to transpire. And he gathers 10 elders, and these are the men who are responsible for town affairs. And so it's very clear from the beginning that Boaz wants to make sure that everything is above board. He wants to make sure that his right to redeem Ruth will not be contested later on. He's being very wise in how he's going about this. And so Boaz begins the proceedings by telling the other kinsmen of a parcel of land that Naomi is selling, and he presents him with the opportunity to redeem it. And this part of the story does require a little bit of explaining, because the laws and the customs that are involved are foreign to our way of thinking, at least somewhat. I have to remember that when the Lord brought the people of Israel into Canaan, the land was apportioned among the tribes and clans of Israel. And the Lord said in his law that those land allotments were permanently given to the clans to which they were given. The allotments were never to leave the families to whom they had originally been given. You could rent out the right to farm the land for a period of years. It could be sold in that sense. But the land itself would always belong to the original clan to which it had been allotted. So the law of the redeemer, or the kinsman redeemer, was put into effect in order to ensure this. The redeemer was a kinsman from the same line as the clan to which the land originally belonged. And it was his responsibility to make sure that the land remained in the family. Now, the text tells us that Boaz told the other man that Naomi was selling this parcel of land. But that's really a little bit of an oversimplification, and it could be misleading. The Hebrew word that's used here does not always describe the act of selling something. It can have a broader meaning. And in fact, in this context, it wouldn't make any sense to say that Naomi actually had possession of this land and that she was entitled to sell it. You know, if that had been the case, well, then why did she and Ruth have to resort to gleaning from somebody else's field in order to make a living? So, in all likelihood, what happened was this. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, back in the days of the famine, he sold the right to farm his land. And then as the funds from that sale diminish, and they get less and less and less, and the famine doesn't go away, he decides to pick up and leave and go to Moab. So when Boaz says that Naomi is selling the land, what he means is that she's relinquishing the right to hold it in trust, and she's authorizing the Redeemer to purchase it back. So the other kinsman hears about this opportunity, and he's interested. And he says that he's willing to redeem the land. It sounds like a pretty good deal to him. He's going to be adding to the inheritance that he will be able to pass on to his heirs and thus perpetuate his name. Now, it's true that there is a cost involved for him, too. As he does this, he knows that Naomi's a part of the picture here. He knows that if he buys the land, he's also going to have to promise to support Naomi in her widowhood. So there's a cost, but that cost will certainly be offset by the income that will be generated by the land. And then on top of that, this kind of puts a feather in his cap in the community. I'm taking care of a widow. So the benefits significantly outweigh the costs. So as the other potential redeemer sizes this up, he sees that, you know, it is in my best interest to take hold of this opportunity and to purchase the land. And he says so to Boaz in front of all these witnesses. And at that point, you know, our hearts almost drop to the ground because we know what that means in light of the larger context of the story. What it means is the other kinsman is going to marry Ruth. He doesn't know it yet, but that's what's going along with this, right? And this is not at all what the reader expects. Ruth doesn't belong with Mr. So-and-so. She's supposed to marry Boaz. As I thought about this, I thought of that movie, The Princess Bride. You remember when the grandfather's reading the story to the little boy and he says that Buttercup married Prince Humperdinck? And the boy says, wait a minute, she can't marry Humperdinck. She's supposed to marry Wesley. You know, it's not the way it's supposed to work out. That's kind of what we're feeling here. But the good news is the story isn't over yet, right? The good news is that Boaz hasn't finished yet. There's one other detail that has yet to be mentioned. And we can imagine how this part of the story might have unfolded. Boaz says, oh, good. Now there's just one other thing. There's something else that goes along with the land. You'll also get to marry Mahlon's widow, Ruth, and provide him with an heir. Talk about letting the wind out of somebody's sails. Boaz, we've seen, he is an upright man, but he's also a shrewd man. He waits until this moment to reveal that the Redeemer will be responsible not only for redeeming the land, but also for rescuing the line of Elimelech from extinction by marrying Ruth and producing an heir through her. So upon learning of this additional piece of information about the transaction, the other kinsman quickly realizes that this changes everything. So what initially sounded like an opportunity that he could not pass up, now all of a sudden it's become something that he wants nothing to do with. And so he tells Boaz right away, I can't do this. I can't redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself. Now, why would he say, lest I impair my own inheritance? What's going on here? It seems like an overreaction, maybe. We might wonder how marrying Ruth would have threatened this man's inheritance. Well, there were several ways. First of all, there would have been a significant cost in marrying Ruth in the first place. There's a bride price and their customs, and that would have made a significant dent in any inheritance that he would be able to leave to his heirs, if he ended up with any heirs. And second of all, the heir that he produced for Elimelech's line through Ruth could potentially end up inheriting his property as well, with the result that his name, the unnamed man's name, would be extinguished from memory. What if he didn't have any other heirs? What if he only had one child through Ruth? He'd get everything. And then on top of that, any child that he would have had through Ruth, even if he had multiple children, they would all be half Moabite. And that's something that most Israelites would have looked down upon. So for those reasons, and probably for more, The other man decides to relinquish his right to redeem Ruth. And this means that the right to redeem is transferred to Boaz. And then this is confirmed by the symbolic custom involving the sandal. Kind of a strange thing to us, but we have our own things that are weird too, you know. So Boaz then confirms what's taken place by the speech that he makes in the presence of the witnesses. And notice that in his speech, he makes special mention of the fact that by marrying Ruth, he is committing himself to perpetuating the name of Elimelech. He says that he is doing this so that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. Boaz fully understands the stakes that are involved here. He knows what he's getting himself into. He has counted the cost. And this underscores the sacrificial nature of his actions in taking on the role of redeemer. It's true that he obtained the field, and it's true that that would have been valuable. It's also true that he won the hand of Ruth, whom he clearly loved. But it's also important for us to understand that he was putting his own heritage, his own name, at risk. And in ancient Israel, that was a big thing. The possibility of having your name cut off from the land was something that was greatly dreaded because of what the land symbolized. It was symbolic of heaven. Israel's connection with the land was a type of the inheritance that belongs to God's people in heaven. So to have your name cut off from the land was considered to be a curse. It was something that any Israelite in his right mind would have done almost anything to avoid. And yet here we see Boaz putting his name at risk in order to preserve a name for others. Well, that brings us then to the final section of the passage where we see the response of the elders and the other people who witnessed what had just taken place. They understand the risk that Boaz is taking. And they recognize what this says about his righteous character. And so they proceed to pronounce a blessing upon him. And they ask, first of all, that Ruth will prove to be as fruitful as Jacob's wives, Rachel and Leah, the two matriarchs of the 12 tribes of Israel. They also pray that Boaz's house will be established, as well established as the house of Perez. Now, you may not know as much about Perez, but in the book of Genesis, we read about how he was born, and it's quite scandalous, actually. It's a situation where there was a widow, a woman named Tamar, she was waiting for her father-in-law to give her the brother of her deceased husband to be her husband. And this was called a levirate marriage, and it's kind of related to the kinsman redeemer principle thing too. But Judah refused to do that, and Tamar tricked him into sleeping with her and ended up producing an heir through her own father-in-law. Very scandalous, and yet ironically, the house of Perez, who was born through that encounter, became a very well-established house in Israel. So it's an interesting blessing that the people are making here. They're making a connection with a situation that had some kind of similarity as what we see with Ruth and Boaz. And although the witnesses could not have known it at the time when they are pronouncing this blessing, the words of their blessing were prophetic in nature. As we see in the concluding section of the book, the union of Ruth and Boaz was used by the Lord to build up the house of David. And remember, it was through the line of David that Christ would come into the world. So Boaz received a heritage that was greater than anything he could have imagined. And in many respects, I think, in light of the things that we've said, we can say that this chapter shows us how Boaz prefigures his greatest descendant. Boaz is in some ways a type of Christ. His selflessness in his redemption of Ruth serves as a foreshadowing of Jesus' self-giving love for those that he came to redeem. And the Apostle Paul writes about this in Philippians 2, when he says this. He says, "Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men." And that passage then continues by saying that because of Jesus' self-humiliation and self-sacrifice in giving himself for us, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. And so we can see there's a similarity between that and what's taking place in these verses that we're studying this morning. In marrying Ruth, Boaz is setting aside concerns about the perpetuation of his own name. And he's doing so in order that he might perpetuate the names of the dead. And the witnesses respond to what they see Boaz doing here by praying that Boaz will be renowned in Bethlehem. And the literal translation of that phrase is, "May your name be proclaimed in Bethlehem." May your name be proclaimed in Bethlehem. So like Christ, Boaz set aside his name, set aside his interests, in order that the names and interests of others might be preserved. And also like Christ, he was rewarded by being given a name that will last forever. Well, the unnamed man in this text was the opposite, wasn't he? He couldn't look beyond his own interests. And as a result, he's simply Mr. So-and-so to us. In trying to save his name, he lost it. But Boaz's name will be remembered forever because of his union with his greatest son, the Lord Jesus Christ. And the lesson for us in this is this. If your ultimate guiding principle in life is serving and advancing your own interests, then you will one day find that you have invested yourself in something that will fade into oblivion. If you want to have a lasting name, if you want to have a lasting inheritance, you need to lose your life for the sake of Christ and his gospel. As Jesus himself put it, "For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul?"